Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Greetings, fellow time travelers. As always, it's lovely to have you with me as we travel together through space and time. Before we get started on today's episode, I'd like to say a big thank you to everyone who supports the podcast series by signing up to my patreon.com site. It's the finances from the Patreon presence that facilitate everything else. That's what keeps the love letters free, as they always have been. So if you're already a member, thank you. If you're not a member and you'd like to join, go to patreon.com, search for me by name, and part with some cash. You can join by the month or by the year, and then you become part of the family, part of the time travelling community. We share question and answer sessions, podcasts and competitions, and we just recognise each other as being those with curious minds, inquiring minds, with lots of questions to ask and a general fascination with history. So there we go. Advert over. It's now time to strap yourselves into the time machine as we set off on the next stop on my love letter to the world. So, recorder, microphone, action. Conquistadors sweep into the Americas, seeking gold and other riches. Along the way, they find a treasure more valuable than all the rest. Nutritious, sustaining, and effective at fending off deadly scurvy. First grown in Europe by Spanish monks in the Canary Islands, popularised by an effective public relations campaign by Louis XVI and his Mrs. Marie Antoinette, boosting populations and powering the European continent. This humble ingredient proved itself to have the power to change the world. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver, and this is my love letter to the world.
Hi Neil. In last week's episode, we travelled with you to the Indian subcontinent in 1526, as a deadly secret weapon was being unleashed there for the very first time. Where are we this week?
Hi Paul. Yeah, well this week we're still in the 16th century, the 1500s, but we've shifted continents yet again. We do get around. We're focused primarily on the Americas, really Central and South America. The story of the world I've been telling across this series has been shaped by the earnest endeavours of men and women and by the great forces of nature. But today I'm focusing on something which is easily overlooked, but that played a major role in the shaping of the world in which we live. It's the humble spud. The geography is quite widespread on this one, but I suppose, you know, the moment of significance in terms of the story of the world, it happens in the Americas, Central and South America. And I suppose the unique selling point of this one is that it's about the world-changing significance of something that we absolutely take for granted in our daily lives. Especially in the West, it's the humble spud, the potato. So it's the role in the story of the world of that most humble but most wondrous of edible plants.
Still utterly loved by everyone, isn't it?
It is. It's deeply rooted metaphorically and literally, I suppose you would say, in our part of the world. And for obvious reasons, people probably don't, why would you bother to contemplate it? But there is no other food crop quite like the potato in terms of how much nutrition it's capable of delivering relative to the surface area of arable land that it takes up. which is why it came to mean so much to the poor, really to the majority of the population of a country like Ireland, for example. The rural population became so lethally dependent on the potato because there was nothing else that you could plant in your back garden that would, in such a confined space, would produce enough nutritious food for a family. And what happened in Ireland was happened elsewhere, in as much as populations became incredibly dependent upon it. The catastrophe of what happened with the potato famine was almost a uniquely Irish experience. However, we'll get to that. It's funny how the names start recurring and recurring as we progress through the story of the world. And Columbus comes up again, obviously, because Christopher Columbus, who was a Genoan mariner, an explorer, who, as we all know, pushed for that passage to the east by travelling into the west. You know, he said, because the world was a ball, you could get into the east by going the other way around and you'd end up in the east eventually. So he went for all those reasons. He went because it was a passion, and also because he was determined to connect Europe to the east via an alternative route. But he was followed, obviously, by those who had more materialist intentions. I mean, I'm not saying Columbus was a saint. I'm not saying he was just, you know, going out there for the good of humanity, but he was followed by conquistadors like Cortes and Pizarro and so on, and they were motivated by the hunger for gold, and it was catastrophic. It was catastrophic for the Americas. In different areas, as much as 90% of the indigenous population died on contact with Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries. A lot of it to do with violence and oppression, but by far the majority of the harm was done by bringing in disease. The Europeans took into the Americas diseases which, common cold and things that had been hitherto unknown, and they just, as I say, almost whole populations were wiped out by the experience. But what goes around comes around. And, you know, and as this story unfolds, you see the way in which, you know, pestilence moves in both directions. So the Spanish, in large part, they came to the Americas, or they went to the Americas in search of gold, but almost inadvertently, some of their number stumbled across something else, which, as things turned out, had at least as much power as gold to change the destiny of populations around the world. So in Peru, Pizarro encountered the Inca population. And famously, anyone who's been to the movies and seen The Royal Hunt of the Sun, the Hollywood epic, will know the story of the kidnap of Atahualpa, who was the king, and his ransom. The ransom that was demanded for his release was to be paid in gold. But even though the Inca came up with the gold, Atahualpa still ended up being throttled to death. It was just part of the long litany of ugliness that unfolded. But some of the Spaniards noticed what the locals were eating. In particular, they noticed what the Inca army were in the habit of eating. You know that thing about an army marches on its stomach and all of that? Well, they noticed that the Inca army depended to a huge extent upon a stew that they called chuno. C-H-U-N-O is how it's rendered into English, chuno. And it was made from potatoes. Other things besides, but potatoes. What the Inca did was they would harvest potatoes and they would leave them out in vast quantities. They would leave them out during the day. You know, they'd be naturally heated. And then at night, especially at altitude, it'd be freezing cold. So the potato crop went through a complete temperature change. So it's going through a hot, cold, hot, cold. And this happens over and over again over a period of time. And then they would press the water, the liquid, out of the potatoes as this process went on, until eventually they could store these things in a sort of desiccated, I suppose a bit like the way grapes become raisins. So they dry them out and shrink them down, but they're retaining all of their nutrition, and they could be stored in this way for, apparently as long as 10 years, Okay, so the Inca had found a way of doing this. And these preserved chuno had a texture, I suppose we would liken it to gnocchi. But the chuno, it was so nutritious that it had become a staple of the diet. The people, and especially the marching, fighting armies, depended upon it absolutely. So some of the Spaniards who were paying attention noticed it, and they started taking the chuno. They learned what to do, and they took chuno and potatoes onto their ships for the return journey. And apart from anything else, it got them over scurvy. You know, scurvy, as we all know, is a vitamin C deficiency that happens when these people are exposing themselves to these week and month-long journeys at sea where they weren't getting access to fresh fruit and vegetables. You know, a terrible vitamin C depletion. Well, the potatoes were full of it, which is to say vitamin C, and so it got them over that so that the journeys could be scurvy-free. Thereby begins the process of transplanting the potato across the Atlantic and into Europe, where it had never been. The potato plant was an unknown in Europe until the 16th century. Spanish monks in the Canary Islands were actually the first Europeans to grow the potato plant. Okay, so they took it on board, as it were, saw the potential of it. And then over the years and the decades thereafter, the crop began to spread. By the 1570s, potatoes were being grown on mainland Spain. And then by the 1580s, it was everywhere else. Britain, Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany, France, Ireland, the potato was there. Now, it's interesting to note that to begin with, people were very suspicious of them. You know how it can be like that sometimes. Something new comes in and people kind of hold it at arm's length. Such was the antipathy, actually, with which the potatoes were first regarded, that rumours began to spread that if you ate them, or even just came into contact with the plant, you could catch syphilis, leprosy, that people would become sterile by connection with. And it's hard to know how these rumours and how these kind of belief systems start to take root, but nonetheless they did. And so for a long time, they were fed to animals. So they became a very handy product for keeping animals fed, but people wouldn't touch them. So the process by which people began to consume potatoes was a slow one in Europe. Eventually, in France, for example, Louis XVI, he of Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake and all of that, Louis XVI was persuaded eventually of the potential of the potato as a food for human beings. And a public relations campaign, an advertising campaign was embarked upon that Louis XVI became part of. And, for example, he would wear a flower, you know, the potato flowers, and he would wear that in his buttonhole to sort of associate himself with it. And Marie Antoinette took to wearing the blooms woven into her hair and so on to push this idea that these were a useful source of food. And it took on and it worked. And eventually the French farmers were growing potatoes and the French people were eating them. And that was something like that happened all over Europe. You know, word began to spread that these things were fantastic. The American historian Alfred W. Crosby is not alone, but he was prominent among those who has identified that potatoes changed the world. In 1972, he wrote a book called The Columbian Exchange, in which he suggested that by crossing the Atlantic to the Americas and beginning the process of bringing American things back to Europe, he began, what would you say, a kind of a stitching back together of a world that had been steadily ripped apart by geological processes spread across eons. Once upon a time, the world was a single continent that geologists call Pangaea. So all of the land was one massive supercontinent. But then, of course, over millions of years, tectonic events, the movement of the tectonic plates, separated everything, you know, so the Atlantic Ocean formed between what we know as the Americas and what we know as Europe, and so on and so on. But there was a process of fragmentation of the landmass. And in those separated places, the Americas, for example, completely independent, disparate ecosystems establish themselves. So different plants, different animals, separated by thousands of miles of ocean, began to evolve independently of one another. And Crosby suggested that it was Columbus started the process by which things started getting pulled back together, if not literally, at least in terms of connections being made and products being exchanged. Now, in that separated American continent, America North and South, in amongst those separate ecosystems, what developed in South America was a family of plants that we know as nightshade. And the potato's one of them. But also from the nightshade plant, we get tobacco, sweet peppers, you know, bell peppers, chili peppers, the eggplant or the aubergine, tomatoes. It's endlessly fascinating to me that we associate the hot food of Asia with the chili, you know, India. But there were no chilies in India or anywhere else in the old world until they started coming back after Columbus crossed the Atlantic. You know, vindaloo, the kind of, you know, the king of hot curried food, is a corruption of a Portuguese term, vindalao, which refers to a sauce made with tomatoes and chili peppers in it. And that became vindaloo. It's not an Indian invention. It came as a consequence of the Portuguese and the Spanish bringing these things back. But it's endlessly fascinating to me that none of these flavors belonged in our part of the world. Tomatoes, peppers, chilies, and potatoes, all of it. We would be without any of that if it hadn't been for the reconnection with the Americas. And it's important to know that the wild potato, in its uninterfered with form, was deadly toxic to humans. You couldn't. The first South Americans that ate a potato poisoned themselves. And in one of those processes that I always find hard to sort of conceptualise, there was then a long period of experimentation. And you wonder what motivates it. You know, you think, if a generation of people learns that potatoes are toxic, why didn't they just leave them alone? You know, why aren't we still avoiding them? But no, some dogged, determined individuals, maybe it was because they were so ubiquitous and abundant. Maybe people thought, God, these things grow everywhere. There's all these, you know, the thing that's tomatoes and the thing that's potatoes and all the rest of it. We really have to find a way to make use of it because they grow like, you know, like nothing else. So maybe it was that. But in any event, a process of experimentation began, which led to all the domesticated variants of the things that we eat. There are now 5,000 varieties of potatoes in the International Potato Centre in Peru. Who knew there was such a place? But there is the International Potato Centre in Peru. 5,000 different varieties of potato, all of them edible. It's extraordinary. Why did it change the world? Well, it is this unavoidable fact that it's an incredibly nutritious plant. The domesticated potato, if you're going to plant one crop to try and feed the largest number of people from the smallest plot of land, it's the potato. That's it. That's how good it is. The historian and thinker Fernand Braudel, in a book called Civilization and Capitalism, but elsewhere, he wrote about how prior to the coming of the potato, Europe was a continent of famines. That was it. All over Europe, famine was a fact of life. People depended upon, in large part, for their daily bread, on the growth of wheat and barley. And those crops were just subject to failure for all sorts of climatic reasons. Not enough rain at the right time, not enough sunlight for ripening of it, and all of the rest of it. The people of Europe just accepted that famine was constantly with them. One of those four horsemen of the apocalypse. They were constantly accompanied by famine. Braudel calculated that France, his home country, experienced a national famine every year from about 1500 to about 1800 AD. And that was only the beginning of it, because as well as famines that affected the whole country all at once, there were uncounted numbers of local famines. You know, so different areas of France would have other famines beside that would harvest yet more people every year. Famine was just constantly there with them. But the arrival of the potato changed all of that, for the most part, because of this ability that it had to provide so much food for so many people from so little land. But of course, as we all know, especially in our part of Europe, the potato was a blessing and a curse at the same time. Because of all of the aforementioned, populations had come to be very dependent on the potato. And in Ireland, for example, the rural population of Ireland, which is to say almost everyone in Ireland at that time, in the 18th and 19th centuries, half the population, their only solid food at all was the potato. It was the only solid food that they got. Half of the people alive, it was all about potatoes. And in other countries around Europe, the same was true for about a third of the population. So in other European countries, one in three people, the only solid food they ever ate was potato. There was a price to pay for that. I mentioned that European diseases went to the Americas and killed uncounted numbers. Well, amongst other things, a South American infestation came back across from the Americas to Europe in the 19th century. It's Phytophthora infestans, and it was a bacterial infection that was there present in seabird guano, which was always used there and elsewhere for fertiliser. You know, seabird guano ploughed into the earth, you know, returns all sorts of nutrients to the ground. But in a particular batch of seabird guano that was coming across the Atlantic, it brought this blight, and the blight, Phytophthora infestans, affected the potato plant like nothing else. In 1845, 750,000 acres of potatoes were lost in Ireland. 750,000 acres. And in the 2 years that followed, 1846, 1847, it was even worse. So for 3 years on the trot, the potato harvest just failed. There were no potatoes. And half the population had nothing else to eat. If they didn't have potatoes, they had nothing. So they had nothing. We could get into the politics of what happened in Ireland. It's remembered in Ireland as An Gortha Mór, which is the Great Hunger. Famine implies an absence of food. But in Ireland, during those hellish years, there was plenty of food. The potato was dying, but everything else was all right, you know. So there was wheat, there was barley, there was pork, the harvest from the sea. Everything else was all right, but the poor were not given access to that food. Now, that is not famine. That's people not being allowed to eat the food that's there. All of that product grown in Ireland, harvested in Ireland, was being put onto ships and transported to Britain and the rest of the world, and the Irish poor were not given access to it. So to call it a famine is largely a misnomer, but you know, we'll get into that sad story at another point in this love letter to the world. But the fact remains that it was a horror show in Ireland during those years. It's estimated that 1 million people died of hunger to begin with, but then along with hunger, another of the horsemen of the apocalypse is disease, because people who are so weakened by hunger, they're not necessarily just dying of hunger, they're dying of everything else besides, to which they become vulnerable because they're so depleted of any kind of energy. So 1 million people died, and something like 2 million people, it's difficult to get exact figures, but something like 2 million people on top of that left. They just fled Ireland. Ironically, a large number of them went to South America. And it was only latterly that people began to understand what had caused the potato famine. It wasn't understood at the time, or what had caused the collapse of the potato crop. But the infestation had come that way, and 2 million people trying to get away from it, you know, they passed each other like ships in the night, so to speak.
Did it happen? Did the blight happen all over Europe?
Yeah, it did. It did. I mean, it wasn't only in Ireland. The problem for the Irish was that the dependence upon the potato crop was so heavy. And also, back to the political, there's no getting away from the fact that the British government and the landowners stood by, is the most you could say, is that they stood idly by while people died. Things could have been done. Steps could have been taken earlier. The impact could have been ameliorated, softened. It didn't have to be as bad as it was. And so for all sorts of other reasons, it wasn't as bad in other places. But what happened in Ireland was a particular British-Irish horror show. There are many factors involved, but there's just no getting away from that fact that, well, the harm being done to the potato crop was widely spread. Its consequences in Ireland were extreme. That's a fact. So the potato had the power to change the world, but, you know, the potato giveth and the potato tooketh away, depending on how dependent populations had become on it. However, that which happened in Ireland notwithstanding, the presence of the potato from the 16th century onwards ultimately powered the population growth that made everything else possible. What the people of Northern Europe were able to do in terms of going out into the wider world and, if you like, placing the shadow of their hand over so much of the rest of the world was due to the population growth and the nutrition that came from the humble potato. You know, empires, emperors and kings have set out to change the world, but nothing had any more impact on the destiny of Europe and thereby the destiny of the wider world than the arrival into Europe of the spud. A fortune in gold and silver is flowing out of the Americas and into Spain when an entire mountain of silver is discovered. It becomes a hell on earth for the indigenous people forced to extract the ore, and riches beyond the dreams of avarice for the Spanish. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new and exclusive history and comment vodcasts every week, sign up to my Neil Oliver Patreon site. I would love to see you there. Check out the Instagram account, which is called Neil Oliver Love Letter. My YouTube channel is simply called The Neil Oliver Channel. And to help build this podcast, tell your friends about it, get them listening, and write a review to convince the online crowd to join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Catnip Inc. The music is composed by Myla McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance is by Catherine and Trudy. The post-production is by Althorp Studios and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. Podcasts production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.